Hello, everyone. My name is Dr. Fergal Armstrong, and welcome to Cracking Addiction. And today we've got with us Mr. Max Lawton, who is a journalist at Fox Sports. And we're going to have a little chat today about the recent controversy that has affected the AFL. So hello, Max. How are you?
Great, Fergal. Thanks for having me.
So, Max, what's happened? Let's stick with the facts. What do we know has happened in the last week?
So what came out in federal parliament, thanks to the independent MP Andrew Wilkie, was these reports from the former club doctor at the Melbourne Football Club, which was regarding the manner in which the AFL's illicit drugs policy was operating. And yeah, it was very secretive for many years. But what they didn't know was that these were drug tests being taken midweek at, you know, clinics related to the club. And then players were being taken out of games before they would possibly test positive for illicit drugs as part of their care plan. Once these players had tested positive once, they received one of the three strikes under the AFL's policy, but then they would be essentially not allowed to receive a second or third strike because they'd be under the medical model, and therefore they would be cared for and looked after more as a patient rather than the punitive model that I think a lot of people expected the drug policy to partake in. So that's what shocked everyone, is the fact that all of this time, for about 19 years now, they've been running this model that is not exactly what everyone thought it would be.
Right. Now, there's a lot in there to break down. Right. So let me just get this straight. If you are a player in a club and you test positive once, you then get diverted into the stream. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then if you subsequently test positive midweek, you're removed from play and therefore removed from testing on game day. Is that right?
Yeah, so the AFL uses two simultaneous drug testing models. Right. They follow the WADA rules under Sports Integrity Australia, formerly ASADA, which is to do with game day testing, with performance-enhancing drugs, and then whether illicit drugs are in your system on game day. If they are in your system on game day, you test within that 24 hours, they're counted as performance-enhancing. But the way they are pausing this system is, in effect saying, hey, to make sure that you don't get tested and have cocaine in your system, for example, they will take you out of the game. And the allegation is that while club doctors have said this is very limited, they would manufacture an injury. It's like, oh, this player has a hamstring concern. And therefore, there's the element of deception is what has, I think, put a lot of people off in all of this.
Yes, right. So I heard on the news that they would be told to pretend to be injured.
Yeah.
Thus subverting the usual WADA regulations.
Yeah, essentially. And I think that's where the AFL has come out and said, we believe we're in compliance with WADA by doing this because WADA does not test during the week anyway. They only are focused on game day testing. So they feel that these systems work concurrently. But whether it's the surprise of how this is operating or whether it's operating at all, that's what got everyone's
So it's the... I won't call it dishonesty. Perhaps it's the subterfuge with which young men, patients, are diverted away from the attention of game day testing. That's the issue, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think there was always an underlying belief a lot of times when certain players would be injured for much longer than expected based on, you know, a hamstring injury lasting for 10 weeks is not what you'd expect. There was a very famous case of that last year with a player that became very under a lot of suspicion. And now I think a lot of people are connecting the dots on that sort of thing. So, which is where it's unfortunate for players who are legitimately injured and are legitimately being taken out of games during the week may now be getting suspicion that they did not warrant.
Right, right. And so just to be clear, there's no requirement for teams to be testing midweek apart from game day. There's absolutely no requirement.
No, my understanding is that the AFL is one of the few sports that does have these dual systems and this midweek testing. I know the NRL, for example, doesn't test during the off-season. I don't believe they test during the week either for rugby league. Yeah. Whereas the AFL and the AFLPA came into this agreement in 2005. It was a voluntary system for players to enter into so that we would have this knowledge and be able to have medical care for them.
Right, so let's go back to the original intent of the system at its inception. So the whole idea was you'd test midweek, you'd identify young men, patients, people, call it what you will, and then do what with them. What was the intent of the original system?
The intent of the system is once you have suffered one strike under the model, you are diverted into this medical stream where they're caring for you and making sure that you are getting the help you need if they feel you are a, you know, persistent illicit drug user. Some of these players may not be having an addiction necessarily, but they may do it in a more of a social sense. But it's ensuring that they are being cared for more, because I think the AFLPA Players Association partnership, I think that's what's really led to this, is they would prefer this medical model over the punitive system.
Right. And so they set up this model, a medical model of midweek testing, to identify people who are at risk of substance use, right?
Yes, that's correct.
And so how would they be diverted? Would it be actually said, right, we're not going to play you because you're going to test positive. We're not going to hide it. Mm. So what's different now? Is it the fact that, you know, where did the system get gamed? That's what I'm trying to work out.
Well, there's a lack of knowledge even within football clubs about who is testing positive. So coaches, for example, aren't being told when their players test positive for illicit drugs during the week. It's purely a patient, you know, doctor situation.
Right, right.
So they have that knowledge, and then they're not being, they are essentially, if they are manufacturing the injury, then the coach is suddenly being told your player is injured when they didn't know that.
Right, but the whole idea about having to manufacture an injury, that wouldn't have been part of the original plan. So I don't understand, what was the original plan for these players?
I'm not sure that that detail has really come out, given that this has been running for such a long time and there's been an expectation that there was something going on behind the scenes.
Right. So earlier on, you mentioned the three strikes rule. Maybe I'm thinking perhaps that maybe this is a way of minimizing the three strikes.
Yeah. Well, only one player has ever actually had a third strike. Travis Tuck, I believe was his name, about a decade ago, became very public. And that, in that situation, he only got the third strike because it was a police investigation. So it became very much public knowledge. So there is an attempt here to keep everything out of the public eye as much as possible. With this three strike model. And I think the expectation, based on the way it was presented to the public, was that we are making sure that if you are doing drugs, you're going to get a strike, you're going to get in trouble. But the concurrent discussions of we're making sure that no one does anything, and also said, unsaid of, well, of course, they're young men in their 20s with disposable income, like the general public, they're going to be using illicit substances. Those things were always contrasting in a way that left people a bit confused.
Right, right. So the original model, we think, said, look, okay, it's diverted. We're going to be open and honest about it. We're going to keep testing. Three strikes and you're out. But, you know, during that time, you're not going to be played, but you're going to be cared for. And now it seems to have morphed into something whereby once you've got the one strike, it's all hush-hush and we're going to fabricate injuries and it's just going to be put under the table. Is that right?
Is that
I'm hearing?
Yeah, I'm not even sure whether it has morphed into that, whether it's just been that's always been, and we've never known.
Right, right. So the AFL is fairly convinced that they are above board and that there is no law that's been broken here.
Yeah, they're of the belief that they're still compliant with the WADA and Sports Integrity Australia rules because they are still testing on game day, and diverting people out of that system isn't, in their view, going against those rules.
Right. But diverting people out of the system by virtue of fabrication of injury, is that against the law? Is that against the guideline? Is that against WADA?
I think if they're going to get in any sort of trouble, that would be the element of it. And that's the part of it that has been downplayed a little bit since the revelations came out in Parliament from Andrew Wilkie. So the element of all of this is that the information came from ousted officials at the Melbourne Football Club who have an axe to grind with the current officials at Melbourne Football Club and want to paint them in a bad light. The degree of which the manufacturing of injuries is happening, there was one doctor from the Gold Coast Suns who said that he's only pulled one player out in his entire run at the club from midweek from using illicit drugs. So whether it's being oversold is also a consideration.
Right, right. So this really could just be a storm in a teacup, couldn't it?
And I think the deception element is what has made it a storm in a teacup as well. The AFL was very clear, and in a way that they are usually not, came out and said, no, we strongly believe this is the right thing to do. This is the best thing for the players, and their care is what matters the most.
Yeah. Yeah. So so that's really the key to that's the gateway to becoming irked is whether or not there's deception here. But if it's an agreement between the players' association and the actual league, well, you know, so be it. You know, if no rule's been broken, so be it. What would you say to that?
I think that's reasonable. The problem that you can still have with it, understanding that a medical model makes a lot of sense, is that there are going to be bad actors in any sort of system. So the allegation or suggestion that players, once they've had a strike, know effectively they cannot get a second, they cannot get in trouble. There's the light penalization of, I'm going to miss a game of footy. I might miss a couple of weeks if I'm doing this during the season. But they're of the understanding that I'm going to get cared for, not punished. So they might be more conscious and more willing to use when they otherwise wouldn't.
So that brings us on to the kind of the broader remit for this discussion, which is what role do male role models, young male role models, play in society? And to what extent should society expect young men to be squeaky clean? And to what extent then should society seek to punish rather than help people who are affected by substances? I mean, those are very valid questions. What would you say to that?
Yeah, I think there's always an expectation of players, because of their public profile, to be effectively better than or more innocent than regular people, which, as we've seen throughout history with, you know, sports and athletes, it's just not realistic in a lot of ways. They're put into a certain position, but going to be any different from another 23-year-old who's suddenly on 400 grand a year when they weren't expecting to be?
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, it's expecting a level of maturity in young men whose brains on a neurocognitive basis aren't mature until 25.
Right.
Expecting them to be able to have the resilience to say no, I think is I don't think it's fair. And from my perspective as a physician, as a specialist in addiction medicine, I don't believe that it's fair to castigate people for substance use. I think I do support the medical model, and I don't believe in punishing substance use. I think the key thing is to actually look at the underlying drivers for substance use and address those. And I think in this position, or in this situation, part of the underlying driver really is the pressure pot the pressure cooker within which these men are living and working. I mean, not only do they have to train and play to their best of their ability, but they are put under the spotlight in ways that other young men just don't have to cope.
Yeah, I was thinking that there would be an element of the public pressure being part of it. And is there an element as well of the social element of drug use as well? There are certainly suggestions. I think the Melbourne Club doctor who came out and gave the documents to the MP suggested that a third of players had nothing to do with drugs, a third were social users, and a third seriously had a problem. Is that something where a culture would develop and they would be more likely to do so because there were more users around them?
Well, there are a number of determinants for substance use, and there are a number of determinants for dependency. So first of all, you've got to understand, you know, that using a substance does not mean you're addicted to a substance. And if the problem is, I've got to stop using, then you have to look at the underlying drivers and treat that. If the problem is, I've got a dependency issue, then you've got to actually treat the dependency and then go back to try and look at the underlying drivers. The way that we understand, the occasional weekend user, is that it's perhaps a gateway, but to further dependency if you cannot control it. But we have to understand it in terms of the drug itself, the psychosocial context, and the genetic predisposition to substance use. And exposure, especially exposure within peer groups, is a risk factor for substance use. But so too is trauma, so too is mental health disorder, so too is neurodevelopmental disorder. So too is a kind of a lax parenting situation. So too is poverty. So if you're growing up under these pressures, then you are going to be at risk of using substances, and then also, you're going to be at risk of getting a dependency. In the context of young men playing for the AFL, I suppose poverty is not really an issue, but it doesn't exclude the possibility that you could have a young man who's grown up tough in a tough suburb, relatively unsupported, and then come good, and then goes into the AFL, and all of a sudden gets put under this pressure, and having been exposed previously, reverts back to a previously useful coping mechanism that then becomes dysfunctional and then lands them up in this treatment pathway. So the reasons for substance use are multifactorial, and they have to be looked at through that, really, that tripartite lens of genetics, psychosocial context, and the actual substance. So, you know, it's not an easy situation. And the figures that you've quoted about a third of people have nothing to do with it, a third of people are dabblers, and a third of people are dependent. Well, that's possibly higher, you know, a third being dependent is possibly higher than I would expect in the general population. But one has to take into account the pressure cooker that is the AFL. And so, you know, I have no reason to doubt that. It's we have to take it at face value. But I would reiterate that my view is that anyone using a substance needs to be treated as a patient, not as someone who merits punishment or for that matter, being managed within a criminal justice system.
So one element that I found important to discuss and difficult as well when talking with my colleagues even throughout this story is that the expectation of punitive punishment really comes in any form of negative activity in society, I think, whether it's crime, homelessness. There's an expectation of people are doing something that we view as wrong, therefore they must be punished. The AFL being very strong on this, saying that, no, we feel the medical model is healthier. How do they balance that line? And perhaps there's the sporting element of the question, which is more for me to answer, but how do they balance that line between needing to treat these people as patients and also needing to, at some point, be a role model to
exactly,
young men
yeah.
And say, yeah, we still need to punish?
Yeah, that's a very good question. Where do you draw the line? How do you meet the competing exigencies of role model and care, basically? And there's a third element to that, of course, that we need to introduce into this, that actually, you know, to what extent is an illicit substance actually an enhancing substance during sports performance? You know, so we're assuming that the substance in question is cocaine, right? So the question then becomes, if you have cocaine in your system on game day, is that truly going to enhance your performance? Well, I mean, you know, I view AFL football as a game of exquisite skill. I'm not convinced that having trace amounts of cocaine in your system is going to increase your performance. I think it probably would decrease your performance. There is the argument that it's a stimulant, and therefore all stimulants increase, stamina. There is that argument, but you know, given the skill element, I'm not so convinced. So there's three aspects, and where we as a society make the decision as to where exactly the tipping point is between the exigency of role model, which therefore merits punishment, and the exigency of care, which therefore merits the patient pathway. Where we put the fulcrum on that kind of seesaw, I don't know. I think this is a decision that society should actually be asked, and I think that there should be a greater public debate on this issue, but it's certainly not, I don't think it's up to one individual to say, oh, you know, they should be punished. I personally would always advocate for the patient model. That's my bias. So, you know, I'm always in the favor of the patient model.
And for what it's worth, I suppose the current system does have some underlying level of punishment when players are being taken out of games, because a lot of them are on salaries but are receiving match payments. So they are at least losing that financial incentive in some degree. So there's something happening there.
Yeah. So, I mean, okay, so let's look at it another way. Let's say that you've got a kind of a community development program, and you go and visit schools, and, you know, your biggest role models find to have a problem with an illicit substance such as cocaine. What are the optics of that? I don't know. I don't know how to answer that question. I suspect that the answer will lie in actually developing maturity within the team players, within the squad, and relying on the older stars, perhaps to do more of the outreach work rather than the younger stars, and, you know, developing a mentor program. I'm just thinking off the top of my head here, but, you know, what can we do as a society? What can we do as a club to maintain those links with grassroots plus protect players?
Yeah, and I think a lot of the there are stronger clubs viewed in terms of having a very strong culture where those older players would be in communication more often with younger players. If there's any sort of division within a group, that would possibly, you know, create schisms that would make things more difficult for those clubs to deal with, and if they have any sort of issues like Melbourne appears to have had. For what it's worth, Melbourne's been very successful while having these issues. They did win the Premiership in 2021. They look very successful again in 2024. So these things can be overcome.
So what do you think is the cure for a culture of substance use within a club? What do you think should happen?
I think they've got the balance right in terms of treatment versus punishment, because the punishments that do happen nowadays when someone does test positive on game day, being suspended for 2 or 4 years can be effectively career ending. And I don't think that's effective as a deterrent. It certainly hasn't stopped people from what we've seen so far. So as in terms of, I don't know that there is a way to stop young men as a whole from wanting to do this sort of thing, because that's just what the usual rate of users would be in normal society. So unless there's a society-wide view that it needs to stop, I don't see how the AFL is going to be stopped at the same rate.
So really, from this discussion, what I'm hearing is that we actually need to inject a little bit of humanity and understanding and compassion into this issue, rather than simply smearing it with the black tar brush of blame. And the only, perhaps the only issue that the AFL might have to explain in more detail is this issue of fabricated injury, but that's for them to explain, not for us to criticize, I suppose.
Yeah, and effectively that is the best of both worlds situation, where if players are being taken out of games, well, there needs to be a reason, because all players are explained, all players have a reason for being removed from games week to week. So if that's what it has to be, that's what it has to be.
That's what it has to be, yeah. Well, Max, I really want to thank you for your time today. It's been a fascinating discussion, and I would look forward to having another chat with you very shortly on any related issue. Thank you very much.
Gladly, Fergal. Thank you.
That's all for today, folks. My name is Dr. Fergal Armstrong, and this has been Cracking Addiction.